obvious to all. Working for Marvel, hopefully illustrating my own superhero series, someone cool that I came up with. Why do you like comic books so much? Sasha asks. I don't know. I guess because most of the superheroes start off as regular people just like us, nerdy and awkward. Speak for yourself, Miranda chimes in. Just like everyone but you, Crystal says, placating her. But something happens that makes these average people realize they're stronger than they thought. Then they believe they can do anything, and what they choose to do is help people. I prefer regular books, Miranda says. You know, without pictures. She's passed Crystal and Sasha on the way up the incline and now walks beside me, the only one of us not fazed by the climb. Ever think about becoming a writer? I ask her. Since you like to read so much. I'm going to be a police detective like my uncle, she says. Why write about crimes when you can solve them in real life? That's called a superhero, Crystal says, with no small amount of satisfaction. Miranda forges ahead to where the incline finally levels off into less wearying terrain, waiting impatiently for the rest of us. Once there, we pause to catch our breath and take in the scenery. On our right, slivers of blue sky peek through the trees. I move instinctively toward them, following the light, emerging from the trees onto a thin strip of craggy ground. Beyond it, the land drops away, and for a dizzying, disoriented moment, I think I'm about to drop with it. I wrap an arm around the nearest tree, steadying myself, my eyes aimed at my feet to make sure I remain on solid ground. When the girls reach my side, one of them, I think it's Miranda, whistles with appreciation. Damn, Crystal says, stretching the word into two syllables. She sounds beyond impressed, awed. I lift my eyes to the horizon, seeing what they see. I realize we're atop the ridge I'd spotted from the canoe overlooking the stone-walled cliff. The view it affords us is stunning. Lake Midnight spreads out below us, the water dappled with sunlight. From this height, I can see the full shape of the shoreline curving inward, the spot in the distance where it narrows toward the dam. Across from us, hazy in the distance, sits Camp Nightingale. It looks so small from here. A miniature, something placed in the center of a model railroad. I dig the map from my pocket and give it a quick peek. Vivian drew nothing to indicate the cliff where we now stand. From what I can gather from her crude markings, we're close to the raggedly triangular rocks. Sure enough, when I turn away from the water and point north, I get a glimpse of rocks through the thick forest. I'm getting closer. To what, I still have no clue. The rocks on Vivian's map differ greatly from the ones I see in person. These are boulders, dozens of them, massive ones that only get larger as we approach, their weight palpable. So heavy and unwieldy, it's a wonder the earth can support them. They sit in a line running up a sharp rise similar to the one we've just climbed. The girls spread out among them, scaling the boulders like kids in a playground. I bet these rocks used to be part of the mountain's peak, Sasha says as she clambers up a boulder twice her height. They froze and broke apart, then glaciers took them down the hill. Now they're here. Explanation aside, the boulders still unsettle me. They make me think of the rumored survivors of Lake Midnight's creation. I picture them when the moon is full, creeping around these very boulders at night, searching for new victims. To push away the unease, I check both the compass and the map, making sure this is where we should be. It is. Hey, girls, I call out. We should keep moving. I squeeze between two boulders and edge around another. That's when I get a view of another rock farther up the incline, one bigger than the others. A monolith. Nearly two stories tall, it rises from the ground like an enormous tombstone. The side facing me is mostly flat, a sheer wall of rock. A large fissure runs diagonally through it, widening at the top. A tree grows inside the crack, its roots curling along the rock face, seeking soil. Standing beside the tree, looking up into its branches, is Sasha. Crystal is up there, too. She takes a step toward the boulder's edge and peers down at me. "Hey," she says. "What are you doing up there?" "Exploring," Sasha says. "I'd prefer it if you stayed on the ground," I say. "Where's Miranda?" "Right here." Miranda's voice emanates from the northwestern side of the giant rock. It sounds watery, akin to an echo. I follow it as Sasha and Crystal scramble down the boulder's opposite side. I work my way around it, seeing another large crack in the rock's side. This one runs in a straight line, widening at the bottom. It opens up completely about a foot from the ground, creating a hole large enough for a person to crawl into, or, in Miranda's case, crawl out of. She climbs to her feet, circles of mud dotting her knees and elbows. "I wanted to see what was in there." "Bears or snakes, probably," Sasha says. "Exactly," I say. "So no more exploring, understood?" "Yes, ma'am," Crystal says. "We understand," Sasha adds. Miranda stands with her hand on her hip, annoyed. "Isn't that why we're out here?" I say nothing. I'm too busy looking past her, my head tilted, eyes narrowed in curiosity. In the distance behind her are what appear to be ruins. I can make out a crumbled stone wall and one jagged wooden beam pointing skyward. I start to creep toward it, the girls behind me. When I get closer, I see that it's the remains of what might have been a barn or farmhouse. The walls are mostly now a pile of rocks, but enough are intact to be able to make out the building's rectangular foundation. Inside are several pines that have sprouted from what's left of the building's roof and floor. In much better shape is a nearby root cellar built into the slope of the land. There's no roof, just a slightly rounded mound of earth. A fieldstone wall forms the front. In the center is a wooden door, shut tight, its rusted slide bolt firmly in place. "Creepy," says Sasha. "Cool," says Miranda. "Both," says Crystal. "It looks like something from Lord of the Rings." But I'm thinking of another, more ominous tale. One about a flooded valley, a clan of survivors hiding in the woods, athirst for revenge. Maybe a small seed of truth lies in the legend Casey told me. Because someone used to live in these hills, the foundation and root cellar make that abundantly clear. And although there's no evidence showing it was the same people from Casey's story, my skin nonetheless starts to tickle. Goosebumps running up my arm. We should go. That's what I intended to say. But I'm stopped by the sight of a large oak sitting 50 yards away. The tree is large, its thick branches spread wide. In its trunk is a familiar letter. X. Immediately, I know it's not the same tree Vivian led me to 15 years ago. I would have remembered the crumbled foundation and creepy cool root cellar. No, this is a different tree and a different X. Yet I get the feeling both letters were carved by the same hand. "Stay here," I tell the girls. "I'll be right back." "Can we look inside that hobbit house?" Miranda asks. "No, don't go anywhere." They mill about the crumbled foundation while I dash to the tree and search around its trunk. I take a step, and the ground beneath me thumps, a muffled, hollow sound. Something is down there. I drop to my knees and start scraping away years' worth of weeds and dead leaves until I reach soil. I swipe my hands back and forth, clearing the dirt. Something brown and moist appears. Wood. A pine plank dyed brown from more than a decade underground. I sweep away more dirt before burrowing my fingers into the soil underneath it, prying the plank loose. Its bottom is coated with mold, mud, a few bugs that scurry away. Beneath the plank, someone has dug a hole the size of a shoebox. Inside the hole is a yellow grocery bag wrapped tightly around a rectangular object. I unfurl the bag and reach into it, feeling more plastic. A freezer bag, the kind that can be zipped shut. Through the clear plastic, I see a splash of green, the stubble of leather, the edges of pages kept dry by the double layers of protection. A book, auspiciously fancy. I peer inside the yellow grocery bag, checking for anything else that might be inside. There's just a second freezer bag, empty and crumpled, and a single strand of hair. I set it on the ground and carefully open the other bag, letting the book slip out of it. It's floppy in my hand, made pliant by 15 seasons of being frozen and thawed and frozen again. Yet I'm able to peel back the cover to the first page, where I see the chaotic swirl of someone's handwriting. Vivian's handwriting, to be exact.
"What are you doing over there?" Miranda calls.
I slam the book shut and shove it into my backpack, hoping my body shields the action from the girl's view.
"Nothing," I reply. "It's not what I was looking for. Let's head back."
I place the now empty bags back in the hole and cover it with the plank. I kick some dirt and leaves over the wood, more out of respect for Vivian than caution. I want to keep her secret safe, because whatever's inside this book, Vivian thought it important enough to hide it here, on the other side of the lake, as far away from prying eyes and Camp Nightingale as possible. 15 years ago.
"Two truths and a lie," Vivian said as we rode back to camp. "Your turn."
I dipped my paddle into the lake, arms straining to push it through the resistant water. Vivian wasn't only older than me, she was also stronger. Each stroke of her oar forced me to paddle even harder just to keep up, which I couldn't. As a result, our canoe curved through the water instead of cutting straight across it.
"Do we have to do this right now?"
I asked through labored breaths.
"We don't have to," Vivian said. "Just like I don't have to tell Allison and Natalie you were too chicken shit to play today, even though I probably will."
I believed her, which is why I opted to play.
I didn't really care what Allison and Natalie thought of me. Vivian's opinion was the only one that mattered. And the last thing I wanted was for her to think I was chicken shit about anything.
"One, my mother got so drunk that she passed out in our building's elevator," I said.
"Two, I've never kissed a boy. Three, I think Theo is the most handsome man I've ever seen."
"You're cheating," Vivian said, her voice sing-songy. "None of those are a lie." She was almost right. My mother had passed out waiting for our building's elevator. I had found her face down in the hallway, snoring lightly, a small puddle of her drool seeping into the carpet.
"But I'll allow it," Vivian said as she pulled her oar from the water and set it aside. "Just this once, mostly because of your incorrect guess during my turn."
"I don't think so," I said. "I totally know you don't have a flask. Besides, I saw that you can't swim."
"Guess again."
Vivian stood suddenly, the canoe rocking as she shed her clothes. There was no bathing suit underneath, just matching pearl-colored bra and panties, silky and shiny in the afternoon glare. Before I could utter a word of protest, she dove into the lake, making the canoe pitch so sharply I thought I was going to tumble in as well. I yelped, grabbed the sides of the boat, waited for it to stop rocking. It was only then that I noticed Vivian slicing the water like a knife through butter. Her strokes were quick, powerful, elegant.
tanned back flattening as her arms swept out in front of her before arcing to her sides. Feet flicking in short, strong kicks, hair billowing like cream in coffee behind her. A mermaid. When she finally came up for air, she was 10 feet from the canoe.
"Wait," I said. "You really can swim?"
She grinned. Her smile was slanted, sly, colored pink by her lip gloss.
"Duh," she said. "But the other day..."
I stopped talking as Vivian ducked below the surface again, emerging with a mouthful of water that she squirted through pursed lips like a fountain.
"You told Theo you didn't know how," I said.
"You can't believe everything I tell you, Em."
I thought about the drama of that day on the beach, the panic, the splashing, Vivian's wide-eyed terror as she flailed. I remembered Becca, her camera trained on the chaos, yet her attention aimed at me.
"I told you so."
"I thought you were drowning," I said. "We all did. Why would you lie about something like that?"
"Why not?"
"Because it wasn't one of your stupid games."
Vivian sighed and began the swim back to the canoe.
"Everything is a game, Em, whether you know it or not. Which means that sometimes a lie is more than just a lie. Sometimes it's the only way to win."
17. The dinner hour is torture, and not just because of the food, which is predictably awful. Runny sloppy joes and french fries. Despite having consumed next to nothing all day, I can only stomach the fries, which glisten with grease. Right now, my main concern is getting back to Dogwood and learning what's in the book Vivian had buried. And that requires privacy, which is in short supply. Skipping dinner to read it would only make the girls more suspicious than they already are. On the canoe trip back across the lake, they bombarded me with questions about the map, the rocks, our purpose for roaming so far from camp. My vague, mumbled answers did little to appease them. So I forced myself to suffer through dinner, delaying the reading of the book until the girls are at the campfire. I take my tray to what's already become known as the adults' table. It's a full house tonight, with every counselor and instructor present, including Becca. She sits at a slight remove from the others, her eyes glued to her phone. I get the feeling she thinks there's nothing left to say to me. I think otherwise. I head to the opposite end of the table, where Casey is listening to the counselors play a game of do, dump, or marry. I remember it well, having played it 15 years ago with Vivian, Natalie, and Allison. Only Vivian had given it a more brutal name. Fuck, marry, kill. As the counselors choose between the men at Camp Nightingale, I sneak a glance at Casey as if to say, "Isn't this such a silly, sexist game?" Yet I suspect Casey is mulling the choices, just like I secretly am.
"I'd do Chet, dump the janitor, and marry Theo," the counselor named Kim or Danica announces.
"I think he's technically a maintenance man," another one says.
"Groundskeeper," Casey tells them. "He's worked for the family for years. He's kind of creepy, but also kind of hot. He'd be my do."
Both counselors look scandalized, their mouths forming twin ovals of shock.
"Over Chet and Theo?"
"I'm being realistic here. There's no way Mindy's going to let Chet out of her sight."
Casey nudges me with an elbow.
"And Emma's already got her hooks into Theo."
"Definitely not," I say. "He's all yours, ladies."
"But the rumor is the two of you had a picnic lunch in the woods."
Across the table, Becca looks up, clearly surprised. She stares at me a second too long before returning her gaze to her phone.
"We were just catching up," I say. "It's been years since we last saw each other."
"Of course," Casey says before leaning closer and whispering. "You can tell me all the sordid details later tonight."
On the other side of the mess hall, I see Mindy enter and make a beeline for our table. She's smiling, which doesn't necessarily mean good news.
I've come to realize Mindy's the kind of girl who wields a smile like a scythe.
Hi, Emma, she says without a hint of friendliness. Next time you decide to vanish for an entire afternoon, I'd appreciate it if you told someone. Franny would, too. She was distressed to hear that you left with a group of campers without telling anyone where you were going.
I didn't know that was a requirement.
It's not, Mindy says, but it certainly would have been a courtesy.
I went canoeing with the girls from my cabin, in case you're keeping a record of my whereabouts. I assume Mindy knows about the camera, and everything else for that matter, especially when she says,
It's just very noticeable when a group of campers goes missing, as you well know.
She stands there, pleased with herself, her next move predicated on how I react. I know because it's right out of the Vivian playbook. I opt for a curveball.
Sit with us, I say, my voice chirpy, so unlike my natural tone. Have some fries. They're so good.
I hold out a fry, the end sagging, its tip dripping grease. Mindy stares at it with thinly veiled repulsion. I suspect she hasn't consumed trans fat since junior high.
No thanks. I have to get back to the lodge.
Not even one fry, I say. If it's calories you're worried about, don't be. You look fine. Later in the night, I wait until the girls leave for the campfire before reclining in my bunk with the meager collection of snacks from my backpack. Gnawing absently on the granola bar, I open the book Vivian had left behind. On the first page, I see a date written in her hand. The first day of camp, 15 years ago. This is a diary. Vivian's diary. I suck in a breath, exhale it back out, and begin to read. June 22nd. Well, here I am, back at Camp Nightmare for another 6 weeks. I can't say I'm thrilled to be back, unlike the Senator and Mrs. Senator, who were ecstatic when I told them I wanted to spend the summer here, and not slutting my way through Europe with Brittany, Patricia, and Kelly. If they only knew that I would absolutely love to be in Amsterdam with those bitches, sucking face with some stubbled douchebag wannabe DJ just for the weed. Everyone seems to think I adore this place. That couldn't be further from the truth. It creeps me out. It has ever since I first got here. There's something not right about it. But here is where I need to be. Just for one more summer. As they say in those shitty movies the senator likes to watch, I've got unfinished business. But will I finish it? That's the big question hanging over this whole summer. Before I left, I asked it to Catherine's stupid magic eight ball that she loved so much. All signs pointed to yes. In the meantime, tomorrow I'll get the pleasure of hearing F give that goddamn speech for the umpteenth time. It's so pathetic how she goes out of her way trying to sound folksy when the rest of us know she's worth $1 billion. You are not fucking fooling us, at least not for long. Nat and Allie are here, of course, fourth camper to be announced. I hope that bottom bunk stays empty. It'll make things easier for all of us, but mostly me. If not, I'll settle for Theodore. I'd sleep on top of him any damn day of the week. My God, he's looking fine. Don't get me wrong, he's always looked fine, but I'm talking fine, worthy even of a dozen lame exclamation points. Pull it together, Viv. Don't get distracted by all that fineness. You're on a mission. Theo isn't part of it, unless he needs to be. Sweet Jesus Lord, I hope he needs to be. Update. It's after dinner. No fourth camper has arrived. Fingers crossed she never does. Update number 2. The fourth camper just came in. A new girl. Time to either terrorize her or befriend her. I haven't decided which one it'll be. June 23rd. Today I showed new girl the ropes. Someone had to. This place is not for the faint of heart. New girl has a name, by the way. It's Emma. Cute, right? And she is. So young and innocent and shaky, like a newborn kitten.
She reminds me of when I was that age, mostly because, underneath that My Little Pony exterior, I think she might actually be a bitch in training. She stood up to me last night, which took major ovaries. I was duly impressed. No one has stood up to me since Catherine died. I missed that feeling of being put in my place. It's tough being the only alpha female in the pack. But, like Theo's divine handsomeness, I can't let New Girl distract me too much. Mission first, friendship second. You know who learned that the hard way. At least I got to roam a little bit after archery. I scoped out all the places I haven't looked yet, including the Big L. I almost made it inside before Casey caught me sniffing around the place. With any other counselor, I would have tried to sneak in anyway, but not her. She's weirdly devoted to this place. I mean, a former camper coming back as a counselor for 2 summers in a row? I can't think of anything more pathetic. My guess is she's obsessed with Theo. It's obvious she's got the hots for him. She throws herself at him every chance she can get. Last year, she caught me flirting with Theo and got all huffy, like she fucking owned him or something. Ever since, she's been dying to get me kicked out. Hence the extra attention I received during cabin check. Like I said, pathetic. June 24th. On her second night at camp, poor Emma had her very first period. She woke me up last night with blood on her fingers like Carrie White. I felt so bad for her. I remember my first period. It was awful. I swear, the only thing that kept me sane was Catherine, who'd been through it all by that point. And where was Mrs. Senator, you ask? Gone, of course. Oblivious. She didn't even know I was menstruating until the maid told her 6 months later. So I did for Em what Kath did for me. Which means, in Carrie terms, I'm Sue Snell in this scenario. Wait, I guess that actually makes me the gym teacher. No, I refuse to be that bore. I'm sticking with Sue. She survived. June 26th. I almost drowned this afternoon. Well, pretended to drown, which isn't quite the same thing. It wasn't planned. I just spontaneously decided to do it. Still, I deserve an Oscar for that performance, or at least a Golden Globe. Best performance of drowning by a regional champion in the 100-meter butterfly. The gulping down lake water part sucked, though. There's probably some creepy waterborne microbe swimming in my stomach as I write this, but it was worth it. I got the reaction I was looking for. While I'm on the subject of drowning, let's talk about Franny's husband for a sec. Don't you think it's strange that a dude who almost made it to the Olympics drowned? I sure as fuck do. June 28th. Holy shit, holy shit, holy shit. I made it into the Big L. At last. I went during lunch when I knew all the campers and counselors would be in the mess hall, and F and her entourage would be dining on the back deck. That gave me enough time to slip in through the front door without anyone noticing. And wow, was it worth the wait. I knew F was hiding something in there, and sure enough, she was. Several somethings. I managed to steal one before Lottie caught me in the study. She acted all cool about it, but I think she was seriously pissed to find me there. And now I'm freaking out because she's going to tell F. I just know it. Not fucking good, diary. My reading is interrupted by a sudden, startling rap on the cabin door. I'd fallen so far down the rabbit hole of Vivian's thoughts that the real world melted away, unnoticed. Now it's back, making me look up from the page and call out in a trembling voice, "Who is it?" "Emma, it's Chet. Is everything okay?" I slam the diary shut, stuff it under my pillow, and take a quick, calming breath before saying, "Yeah, I'm fine." The door opens a crack, and Chet peers inside, his hair a swoosh over his eyes. He pushes it away and says, "Can I come in?" "Make yourself at home." He steps inside and takes a seat on my hickory trunk, his long legs extended, arms crossed. Although he and Theo aren't biologically related, the two nevertheless share some traits.
Both have the height and physique that makes everything they wear seem perfectly tailored. Both move with athletic grace, and both radiate that laid-back, carefree vibe that comes from being to the manor born. Or, in their case, adopted.
"I noticed you weren't at the campfire," Chet says. "I wondered if something was wrong. You know, after what happened at lunch."
"Which one of them sent you, your mother or your brother?"
"Neither, actually. I came on my own. I wanted to clear up a few things. About the camera and why my mother invited you back here. Both were my idea."
I sit up in surprise. Yesterday, I had wondered if Chet even remembered who I was. Clearly, he did.
"I had assumed both were Franny's idea."
"Technically, they were, but I'm the one who instigated them."
Chet gives me a grin. It's a great smile, another thing he and his brother have in common.
"The camera was just a precaution. Theo and my mother had nothing to do with it. I thought it would be a good idea to monitor your cabin. Not that I expect anything bad to happen, but it doesn't hurt to be prepared in case it does."
It's a polite way of saying that he, too, knows about my fragile mental state after my first stay here. At this rate, it'll be common knowledge among every camper and kitchen worker by the end of the week.
"Please don't be offended," Chet says. "I understand why you felt unfairly targeted, and I'm sorry. We all are. And if you want it taken down, I'll get Ben to do it first thing tomorrow morning."
I'm tempted to demand that it be dismantled right this instant. But oddly, I also understand the need for caution. After what happened in the shower this morning, or more accurately, what might have happened, it's not a bad idea to monitor the camp.
"It can stay," I tell him, "for now, and only if you tell me why it was your idea to invite me back here."
"Because of what you said back then," Chet says, "about Theo."
There's no need for him to elaborate. I know he's referring to how I told police Theo had something to do with the girl's disappearance and never took it back. Both are actions I've come to regret. The former because of why I blamed him, the latter because it would mean admitting to all that I'm a liar. Two truths I'm not yet ready to face.
"I can't change what I did back then," I say. "All I can do is tell you that I regret it and that I'm sorry."
Chet raises a hand to stop me.
"Getting an apology isn't why I told my mother she should invite you back here. I did it because your presence says more than any apology ever could."
So that's why Franny was so eager to have me return to Camp Nightingale. She had pitched it as a way to show that the camp was a safe, happy place again. In truth, my being here is a silent retraction of what I said about Theo 15 years ago.
"Because I'm here again, it means I think Theo is innocent," I say.
"Exactly," Chet says. "But it's more than that. It's an opportunity for closure."
"That's why I decided to come."
"Actually, I was talking about Theo. I thought having you here would be a chance to make amends, that it would do him some good. God knows he needs it."
"Why?"
It's the only thing I can think to say. Theo is handsome, wealthy, and successful. What else could he possibly need?
"Theo's not as put together as he looks," Chet says. "He had a rough time after what happened here. Not that I can blame him. The police kept questioning him. Vivian's father said some awful stuff about him, as did the press, and Theo couldn't take it. Dropped out of school, went heavy on the drugs and alcohol. Rock bottom came on the 4th of July, a year after the disappearance. Theo went to a party in Newport, got lit, borrowed someone's Ferrari, and smashed it into a tree a mile down the road."
I shudder, recalling the scar on Theo's cheek.
"It's a miracle he survived," Chet continues. "Theo got lucky, I guess. But the thing is, I'm pretty sure he didn't plan to survive that crash. He's never come out and admitted he was trying to kill himself, but that's my theory. For months he had certainly acted like someone with a death wish. Things got better after that. My mother made sure of it. Theo spent 6 months in rehab,
went back to Harvard, finally became a doctor, although 2 years later than he had planned. Because everything eventually went back to normal, none of us talk about that time. I guess my mother and Theo think I was too young to remember, but I do. It's hard to forget watching your only brother go through something like that. He stops talking, takes a deep breath, lets out a long, sad sigh. I'm so sorry, I say, even though it's meaningless. It doesn't change what happened. I can't erase the pale line that now runs down Theo's cheek. I don't know why you accused him, Chet says. I don't need to know. What matters is that you don't believe it now. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. I don't want you to feel bad. But I feel worse than bad. Truly villainous. I can't even will myself to look at Chet. Instead, I stare at the floor, mute and guilt-ridden. Don't beat yourself up over it, Chet says as he stands to leave. That's the last thing any of us want. It's time to let go of the past. That's why you're here. It's why we're all here. And I hope it'll do everyone some good. 18. I wait a full 5 minutes after Chet leaves before diving back into Vivian's diary. It stays under my pillow as I count the seconds. I'm not worried about him returning to interrupt me once again. It's more of a moment to decompress after what he said about Theo. Even though he told me not to beat myself up, I can't help it. Theo spent 6 months in rehab, probably at the same time I was being treated for my own problems. Our first years after Camp Nightingale were almost identical. The only difference was the demons we faced. Mine looked like Vivian. Theo's looked like me. Again, I know I can't repair the damage I've caused him. That opportunity passed 15 years ago. But I can prevent further damage if I find out more about what happened to Vivian, Natalie, and Allison. He'll no longer have suspicion trailing after him like a shadow. He'll be free. And if it happens to him, it could also happen to me. When the 5 minutes have elapsed, I remove Vivian's diary from under my pillow, flip to where I had left off, and dive in once more. June 29th. It turns out I was right. Lottie told F, who pulled me aside after lunch and basically went apeshit on me. She threatened to call the senator, as if he'd fucking care. She also said I needed to respect personal boundaries. I felt like telling her to shove those personal boundaries up her dusty twat. I didn't, because I need to keep my head down. I can't rock that damn boat until it must be capsized. So, to recap, bad news, she definitely suspects something. Good news, I'm close to finding out her dirty little secret. July 1st. I'm thinking about telling Emma. Someone needs to know in case something happens to me. July 2nd. Well, that sucked. I decided not to tell Em the whole truth about what I'm doing. It's safer for her that way. Instead, I opted to hint at it by taking her to my secret stash in the woods. You guessed it, the box. The thing that started this whole investigation when I found it last summer. I thought showing it to Emma would spark her interest, just in case the magic eight ball lied and all signs actually point to getting my sorry ass booted from camp. That way she can continue what I started if she's so inclined. And I was right. It did spark her interest. I saw it in her eyes as soon as she opened that box. But then the bad stuff had to take place. Yep, I showed her that I could swim. I thought she should know, for several reasons. One, if, God forbid, my body washes up on the beach one morning, she'll be able to tell police that I'm an expert swimmer. Two, she needs to learn not to trust everything everyone tells her. Two truths and a lie isn't just a game. For most people, it's a lifestyle. Three, I'll need to break her heart eventually. Might as well put a crack in it now. So now she's pissed at me,
Rightly so. She spent the rest of the day ignoring me, and it hurt like a motherfucker. There's so much I want to tell her. That life is hard, that you need to punch it before it punches you. I know she's hurt. I know she thinks she's the only one whose parents ignore her. But she should try being left behind in New York while the Senator and Mrs. Senator go off to D.C. 2 months after her sister dies. Now that's abandonment. As for the fake drowning, I had to do it. Hopefully M will only pout a day. I'll give her flowers tomorrow and she'll love me again. July 3rd. Fun fact, in the 1800s, women could be sent to asylums for these reasons. Hysteria. Immoral life, jealousy, masturbation, kicked in the head by a horse, egotism, nymphomania, bad company, novel reading, parentheses, exclamation point. Other than the horse kicking, every single woman I've ever met could have been declared insane back then. Which is exactly how men wanted it. It's how they managed to keep women down. Don't like something they've said? Call them crazy and ship them off to the loony bin. Don't fuck their husbands enough? Commit them. Want to fuck them too much? Commit them. It's sick. And don't you dare think things have changed much, diary. They haven't. The senator was ready to have me locked up after Kath died. Like it was wrong of me to mourn her. Like grief was a mental illness. Anyway, that's the lesson I learned today. Every woman is crazy. The ones who can't hide it well enough are shit out of luck. 150.97768 West 164. Update. And now I'm fucked. I forgot I left you out, dear diary. Came back from the campfire to find Natalie and Allison reading you, which doesn't surprise me. They've been trying to get a peek at you all week, and now they have. I'm sure it was an eyeful. Thank God I didn't write that Natalie's gotten so thick in the thighs she looks like a lady wrestler, or that Allison's so pasty she might as well be an albino. That would be awful if they read that about themselves, right? And while I'm tempted to leave you open to this page so they can do exactly that, I've decided it's best to hide you. You're no longer safe here, baby. The less they know, the better. Update number 2. Welcome to your new home, little book. Hope you don't rot here. Drawing a map so I don't forget where you are. July 4th. Can't write much. Rowing here already took half the morning. Rowing back will take even longer. F has probably noticed I'm gone. She's got spies everywhere. I'm certain she told Casey to double-check on me each night. But that might not matter for much longer, because I found it. That cliched missing piece that ties everything together. Everything makes sense now. I know the truth. All I need to do is expose it. But there's a hitch. After reading you, dear diary, Natalie and Allison want in on it. And I've decided I'm going to tell them everything, because I can't do this without their help. I thought I could, but that's no longer an option. Yes, I know I could just drop it, forget the whole thing, spend my summer, my year, the rest of my goddamned life pretending it never happened. A sane person would do that. But here's the thing. Some wrongs are so terrible that the people responsible must be held accountable. Call it justice, call it revenge, call it whatever, I don't give a fuck. All I care about is this particular wrong. It can't be ignored. It must be righted. And I'm the bitch that's going to do it. I'm scared. 19. That's it. The rest of the pages, more than two-thirds of the diary, are blank. I flip through them anyway, just in case I've missed something. I haven't. There's nothing. I close the diary and exhale. Reading it has left me feeling the same way I did after each of Vivian's hallucinatory visits. Confused and lightheaded, spent and frightened. Vivian was looking for something, that much is clear,
What it was, and what she eventually found, remain frustratingly out of reach. Honestly, the only thing I'm certain about is that the paper on which Vivian drew her map was torn from the journal. There's a page missing between her entry about its new location and the one she made on the 4th of July. I remove the map from my backpack and hold it against the ragged remnants of the missing page. It's a match. I reread the entire diary, studying each page, parsing every word, trying to make sense of it. Little does, least of all, why Vivian, a person who rarely failed to say exactly what she was thinking and feeling, needed to keep something secret. So I give it yet another read, this time from back to front, starting with Vivian's unsettling final entry. I'm scared. That one confounds me the most. Of all the myriad emotions Vivian displayed in the short time I knew her, fear wasn't one of them. I flip to the previous page. That entry was made the morning of July 4th, prompting two new questions. When did she write that final entry, and what was she afraid of? I clutch the book, frustrated, aching for answers that refuse to reveal themselves. What did you learn, Viv? I murmur, as if she could somehow answer me. Judging by the entry dates, I assume she buried the book sometime during the night of July 3rd. My guess is that she snuck out while the rest of us were asleep. Not unusual for her. She had also done it the night before. I remember because I was still mad that she had lied to me about her swimming skills. I was especially livid about the reason she lied. Because Theo had been paying too much attention to me. She saw me in his arms, whispering encouraging words as he taught me how to swim. And she couldn't stand it. So she faked drowning just to become the center of attention again. I ignored her the rest of that canoe trip back to camp, and the rest of the afternoon. And at dinner, where I took her advice and showed up so late I was last in line. I sat alone and picked at the dinnertime dregs, lukewarm meatloaf and mashed potatoes dried to a crust. At the campfire, I sat with girls my own age, who showed little interest in me. Afterward, I went to bed early, pretending to be asleep while the others played two truths and a lie without me. Later that night, I woke to find Vivian tiptoeing into the cabin. She tried to be sneaky about it, but the creak of the third floorboard from the door gave her away. I sat up, bleary-eyed.
"Where did you go?"
"I had to pee," Vivian said. "Or is taking a piss something else you disapprove of?" She said nothing else as she climbed up to her bunk. But in the morning, a handful of tiny flowers were sitting on my pillow, right beside my head. Forget-me-nots. Their petals were a delicate blue. In the center of each was a yellow starburst. I later stored them in my hickory trunk, pressed inside my copy of The Lovely Bones. Although she never admitted to putting them there, I knew they were from Vivian. She had indeed given me flowers. And just as she thought, I loved her again. I flip back to the page where Vivian had made that prediction, reading it feverishly, wondering again if my feelings had been that transparent. It's only after I reread the passage about her own parents that I get an answer. Vivian simply knew, because she was just like me, neglected and lonely, basking in whatever scraps of attention she received. It's how she was able to foresee that a hastily picked bunch of forget-me-nots would be enough to appease me. Because it would have been enough for her, too. More flipping, more pages, more questions. I turned to the page with Vivian's musings about insanity. Of all the things she had written, this one shakes me to my core. Reading it feels as though she's speaking directly to me, as if she foresaw my slide into madness a year before it would happen. But why did she seek out that information? And where? I vividly remember the day she made that entry.
riding to town in the camp's mint-green Ford, squeezed tight between Vivian and Theo at the wheel. He drove one-handed, his legs spread wide so that his thigh kept bumping against mine. Each touch made my heart feel like a tiny bird trapped in a cage, fluttering against the gilded bars. I didn't mind at all when Vivian said she was going shopping and slipped away from us, leaving me alone with Theo. I flipped to the next page where she had jotted down that strange set of numbers. 150.97768 West, 164. At first, I think they might be coordinates on a map. But when I grab my phone and check the compass app, I discover that 150 degrees points southeast, which means it's something else. Only Vivian knows for sure, but I'm certain she wrote down the numbers for a reason. Like everything else, I get the sense that she's urging me forward, step by step, to find out what she learned all those years ago. I'm in the process of taking a picture of the numbers with my phone when the door to Dogwood opens and Miranda, Crystal, and Sasha burst inside. Their sudden presence sends me once again scrambling to close the book and shove it under my pillow. I'm not as quick this time around, allowing them to catch me in the act. "What are you doing?" Sasha asks, eyeing first the corner of the book poking from beneath my pillow, and then my phone, which remains clutched in my hand. "Nothing." "Right," Miranda says. "You're totally not acting like someone just caught looking at porn." "It's not porn," I pause, trying to see if the girls believe me. It's clear they don't, so I tell them the truth, minus any context that would make them ask more questions. I'm trying to decipher something, a code. Miranda's face lights up at the idea of solving a mystery. "What kind of code?" I glance at the picture on my phone, reading off the number. "What does 150.97768 West mean to you?" "Easy," Miranda says. "It's the Dewey Decimal System. Some book has that call number." "You positive?" She gives me a disbelieving look. Yeah. I've spent like half my life at the library." The library? Maybe that's where Vivian went when she claimed to be shopping. While there, she found a book important enough to note its call number in her diary. It's clear she was looking for something. I even think she might have found it. I recall her entry about getting somewhere she wasn't supposed to be. The big L is the lodge, F is Franny, simple enough. But Vivian frustratingly failed to mention exactly what she found there and what she managed to steal. Still, she wrote enough to thoroughly unnerve me. Thinking about Franny's reaction to her snooping sends a chill flapping through me. It doesn't sound like Franny at all, which makes me wonder if Vivian was being paranoid. It certainly seems that way, especially Vivian's line about wanting to tell me what she was doing in case something happened to her. I'm close to finding out her dirty little secret. It turns out something bad did happen, only there's no proof it had anything to do with Franny, or a deep, dark secret. Yet some events are too connected to be mere coincidence. This feels like one of them. I know the truth. The idea that I might be closer to learning what happened to the girls should excite me. Instead, a hard ball of pain forms in the pit of my stomach, worry snowballing inside me. I assume Vivian experienced this exact feeling when she scribbled those last two words in her diary. "I'm scared." So am I. Because it's possible I've stumbled upon something sinister, even dangerous. That after years of wondering, I'm on the cusp of getting actual answers. Above all, I'm scared that if I keep digging, I might not like what I find. 20. That night, my dreams are haunted by Vivian. It's not like the hallucinations of my youth,
Never do I think she's really there, returned from the ether. There's a cinematic quality to them, like I'm seeing one of the film noirs my father still watches on Sunday afternoons. Vivian in expressionistic black and white, first running through a forest as wild as one of my paintings, then on a barren island holding a pair of scissors, finally in a canoe, rowing mightily into a rolling fog bank that whooshes over her, swirling and hungry, ultimately consuming her. I wake clutching my charm bracelet as reveille blasts through camp. To my utter surprise, I have slept through the night. My eyelids flutter, tentatively facing the light of morning. Even before they're fully open, I can make out something at Dogwood's sole window. A shape, dark as a shadow. A gasp catches in my throat, lodging there, momentarily blocking all breath, as whoever's at the window flees. I can't tell who it is. All I see is a dark figure streaking away. Only when it's gone do I swallow hard, suppressing the gasp, forcing it back down. I don't want to wake the girls, nor do I want to scare them. When I notice Sasha squinting down at me from her upper bunk, I can tell she didn't see whoever was at the window. All she sees is me sitting up in bed, my face as white as my cotton pillowcase. I had a nightmare, I tell her. I read that bad dreams can be caused by eating before bed. Good to know, I say, although I'm pretty sure my dreams of Vivian were caused by her diary and not what little I ate last night. As for what I saw at the window, I'm certain it wasn't a dream. Nor was it my imagination or a play of the light, like I tried to convince myself is what happened at the latrine. This time, there's no talking myself out of it, no matter how much I'd like to. Someone was there. I still feel their presence, a ghostly hum right outside the window. My pulse races, humming in response. It tells me that I wasn't mistaken about yesterday. Someone had watched me in that shower, just like someone trapped those crows inside the cabin. And now someone was just watching me sleep. I shudder, horrified, my skin crawling. If the girls weren't here, I'd let out a scream, just because it might make me feel better. Instead, I slide out of bed and head to the door. "Where are you going?" Sasha whispers. "Latrine." Another lie, tossed off to keep Sasha calm. Unlike me with my still furious pulse and continuing shudder as I bolt outside to see if I can spot whoever was at the window. But already dozens of girls are spilling out of their cabins, roused by reveille and groggily starting the day. All of them stop when they see me. They also stare, some with their heads tilted in curiosity, others with outright surprise. A few more campers join the fray, doing the same thing. As does Casey when she passes by with two fingers pressed to her lips, already craving that first cigarette. That's when it dawns on me. They're not staring at me. Their gazes are fixed on the cabin behind me. I turn around slowly, not sure if I want to see what the others do. Their expressions, a little fearful, a little stunned, tell me it's nothing good. But curiosity keeps me spinning until I'm facing the front of Dogwood. The door has been smeared with paint. Red, still wet, sliding down the wood in rivulets that resemble streaks of blood. The paint forms a word spelled out in all caps, the letters large and bold and as piercing as a knife to the ribs. Liar. Franny again stands before a mess hall filled with campers, although this time it's to give a different kind of speech. "To say I'm disappointed is an understatement," she says. "I'm devastated. Vandalism of any sort will not be tolerated at Camp Nightingale. Under normal circumstances, the culprit would be asked to leave immediately. But since you all have only been here a few days and may not yet understand the rules,
Whoever painted on the door of Dogwood will be allowed to stay if you come forward now. If you don't, and are later caught, you'll be banned from this place for life. So please, if any of you are responsible,